put the kettle on.
Enjoy massive, a fine bit of cherry pie.
In heaven, everything is fine. In heaven, everything is fine.
And while you're in heaven, be ready to savour
the taste
of a good bit of Keno.
Here and you're not, you're there. Let's begin.
Okay, so this is welcome back. fucking once again, jittery intro because we don't know how to fucking open an episode anymore.
It's a funny gimmick.
Our gimmick that I'm sure countless other people have done, but it's our gimmick.
That's right, Tony. Laugh at the funny joke.
I can't laugh. I have a condition where I can't laugh anymore.
Constant pain. Well, we'll see, because our job is to make each other laugh about stupid things in movies. Exactly. But I'm going to fix this problem for you, Kevin. Oh, open your mouth. Open wide.
Oh, shit.
Right. Hello. Welcome back to A Good Bit of Keno. Today we're going to be looking at some weird shit. We're back into the weird shit again. Welcome to Weird Shit Wednesdays, though this is being recorded
if
on
anything. I mean, weird shit is our thing. We like a bit of the old weird shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say weird shit is our sort of niche, even though a lot of people like weird shit, but we're different. We like different things.
We're different because we have the goal to talk about it on the internet where we can profess our love of weird shit to hypothetically an ocean of anyone.
It could be anyone. So yeah, we have been graced by this gift that's known as tier maker, which allows you to make tier lists of anything you want. Favorite curries you've eaten in the last week, your dad's dubious videos that he's got in his wardrobe, or, I don't know, like, dog baskets. Anything you want, you can rank on an S to F scale.
You could easily do your top 10 Albanian pornographies.
Yeah, and some people may have done that. I don't want to search that because that's an incredibly personal list to those individuals, and I wouldn't want to, encroach on that.
Don't encroach on any of their personal business, any of their personal Albanian pornographies.
Yeah. What they like, they keep within closed doors, even though they made that tier list for the entire internet to see.
Now everyone can rank obscure Albanian pornographies.
Fuck yeah. Do you see why the internet connection, that's a problem? Do you see why internet is an issue? Because it allows you to do this?
Tim Berners-Lee is just crying. It's like crying sour tears at the idea of someone is using his invention of the World Wide Web to talk about obscure Albanian pornographies.
Yeah. And on the subject of sour tears, we're going to go on about our boy, the subject of this this weird escapade, David Lynch. A round of applause for David Lynch, everyone. Don't put the round of applause in.
I was going to clap as well, but then you told me not to.
I've stopped you.
You ruined it.
In your tracks.
You ruined my clapping.
Yeah. You're going to have to learn to live and let live, son. Deal with it.
I'm going to clap in post just to fuck you up.
Fuck's sake. I mean, I'm not in control of editing this, so yes, you will. Bastard. Okay. David Lynch. He's known as many things. He's known as Grumpy Old Man. He's known as Man with Radiators. He's known as man who likes coffee, even if it's bad coffee. But he's also known for being a very experimental and surrealist filmmaker with a very sort of untracked passion for making films that are very personal to him and that are kind of hard to sort of dissect from any other angle. No answer is the right answer. and wrong answers are probably also in the same group, because it's very hard to analyze these films. It's very hard to discuss these, because most of the time Lynch will probably just laugh at you and say you're a fucking idiot for even trying. But yeah, you know.
I mean, that's essentially what he does every time any form of Eraserhead discourse happens in, like, the film community. If he ever catches fucking wind of it, he just, like, laughs about it and says, no, I'm not telling you.
Yeah.
There's a brilliant book, like an interview book between him and somebody else called Lynch on Lynch. And one of the segments is about Eraserhead. And the guy, like, obviously when you're interviewing David Lynch, you're going to try and ask him, oh, what do you think this means in your film? Oh, what does this mean? And he just sort of sits there and goes, well, I don't particularly care what it means because I know what it does mean. So anyone else can make it mean whatever they want. It'll be wrong,
yeah,
but they can have their own meaning of it.
And that's always been an interesting angle that he has as a filmmaker, because, I mean, you'd expect a lot of filmmakers to encourage discussion because obviously art is subjective and what people think about a certain work might be different to what an artist originally intended. But Lynch's approach to filmmaking and stylization is very, very insular, and it's always focused on his vision, which is very hard to intrude upon, and it's very hard to sort of explore. But that's not a problem, because we're going to say fuck you, Lynch, for the first time in history, and we're getting straight in there.
Fuck you, the man who didn't really want to make films in the first place, he just wanted to paint.
Yeah.
Fuck him. Honest, I think that's kind of why sort of analysing his films is so difficult, because he approaches filmmaking in the same way that he approaches, like, doing a painting or a sculpture, in that this is something that you're supposed to look at and just go on, like, what is the original artist's intention for it? Yeah, you can have your own subjective emotional response, but is that going to be what the artist originally intended? Potentially no, but David Lynch doesn't care what you think. David Lynch does not care about your feelings, so never talk to him.
Yeah. He was doing Facts Don't Care About Your Feelings before Shapiro was, and that takes guts.
That does take a lot of guts.
But yeah, we're here today to rank his films. Now, this is never an easy job because, you know, as we've said, people make films for different reasons, and Lynch makes films for very particular reasons that are quite starkly different to many other filmmakers. So when trying to rank that and seeing how vastly different some of these works are, it's a bit of a mess trying to go through it with another guy and be like, yeah, I think fucking Dune is S rank. Yeah.
I know some people who do really love his Dune adaptation and are like, oh yeah, this was my Star Wars. And I'm like, well, do you really think it's your Star Wars? Is it really as sort of good or as influential as any of those things?
Yeah.
The movie is not. The book is astonishing, but I'll talk more about the book later.
Yeah, we'll get onto the book. My mate does like the book quite a lot.
I do like the book a lot.
He does enjoy book. But yeah, so what's interesting is when you look at the critical receptions of most of these films is that they're always very polarizing, always quite mixed. Or at least in, like, the contemporary time, you'll see scores that vary from critics that are quite low to medium. But then you look at the legacy that these works leave on future filmmakers, on aspiring artists or writers, and you go, ah, now this is pretty cool. Mm. So yeah, we're looking at a lot of weird, wacky shit today, so buckle up.
Yeah, we'll be ranking his 10 feature films.
Yeah.
We could have spiced this up, throw in a few of his weird short films, but there's so fucking many of those that it's Rabbits. Just impossible to rank them properly.
Rabbits. That's a good one.
The alphabet's quite good.
Yeah.
what's the one he did for Netflix about the monkey? I like that one. I like the monkey one. What did Jack do? That's the one. What did Jack do where he's interrogating a monkey?
I think I remember that one.
I mean, it's on Netflix. It's like anyone could watch it if they have a Netflix subscription. Like, it's just there.
Oh, yeah. Hang on.
I'm 100% sure he also voices the monkey.
Yeah. I remember this. I've not seen it yet, but I'm probably going to, after this episode, I'm gonna watch that.
It's great.
I like monkeys.
Just two of them sat in a train station talking about, like fuck, it's like a fucking film noir thing.
Yeah.
And there's a chicken. At one point, the monkey has a musical number.
Fantastic.
I think it's like 17, but he comes a lot into 17 minutes.
That's straight funky, that. But yeah, I say, let's get going. The audience probably knows who this man is anyway. We do.
Anyone who has like any kind of passive knowledge about film will know one David Lynch film, because most likely they'll know something like The Elephant Man, or
yeah,
they'll know like, oh, didn't he do like Twin Peaks in the 90s? It's like, yes, that is a David Lynch thing.
That is the same man.
Same man.
So yeah, I say we'll just head straight into the thick of it.
So we're going to go back all the way to 77, with David Lynch's first feature film, Eraserhead.
Yeah.
What are we thinking about Eraserhead then? Because a lot of people, this is, I think, arguably his most beloved movie.
Yeah.
Because it's the one that a lot of people are like, oh, you haven't seen Eraserhead. Oh, you should definitely see Eraserhead. Like, they always do it with that kind of ironic eye roll of, oh, well, no one's ever seen a movie like this, so this will frighten them from ever seeing a movie again.
Hmm.
I showed my girlfriend Eraserhead one evening.
Bruh, no.
We watched the whole thing, and she was like, I don't know what this is. The baby terrifies me. I never want to talk about it again. Please never bring it up in conversation.
Jesus Christ. So that was a mistake.
So, that's quite concrete proof. This movie has a very polarizing sort of, can have a very polarizing effect on people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's always quite a volatile response you'll see that people have towards most of Lynch's films. But I feel it's at its peak with Eraserhead. Mm. I feel like it's the go, for me, it's the go-to film that people talk about in most circles, aside from some of his later works in his weird little LA trilogy. But it's just a very confusing and quite a violent inquiry into the idea of male paranoia, and I suppose like the anxiety that comes about parentage. But there's more to it than that. There's always more to it than that, and you can't really deconstruct it in any specific way and be like, ah, yeah, there you go. I think for me, there was a lot of elements in Eraserhead that I really liked with, I felt there was a lot of like Kafka imagery in it that was funky.
There was a lot of kind of Kafka-esque stuff going on in it, but I always sort of interpreted it as this sort of great metaphor for parenthood. And I like a lot of the pseudo-sexual imagery that's sort of going on within the movie.
There's always pseudo-sexual stuff going on.
That's one thing that kind of runs quite strongly throughout all of Lynch's films. There is like a weird, strong, not sleazy, not seedy, but definitely kind of sinister sexual element.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, even in the premise, it just feels abhorrent. It's quite simple. It's just some bloke who gets left with this fucked up kid. This poor babby. This poor babby in a desolate desolate, horrible place.
In any other movie, this is like quite a stock plot of man is in love with woman, woman can't deal with child, so she leaves. Man has affair with woman in same apartment complex. Man's head gets turned into pencil erasers. Man kills baby. You know, it's sort of the classic Hollywood rom-com formula.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that, and this as is the same with like Lynch's other works, is that his experiences in life always sort of lean in on the narrative. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Lynch's experience when he was living in Philadelphia sort of reflect that. Not to the same extent. I mean, Philadelphia is kind of a nuclear wasteland, but not to the extent that
Lynch... Razorhead presents it.
Yeah. So there's, I'm seeing now there was a quote from him when he was talking about his experiences of him seeing so many things in Philadelphia that no one could believe, such as a grown woman who was grabbing her breasts and speaking like a baby, complaining that her nipples hurt.
Oh, dude.
Just weird shit like that that you can see that sort of implicates on the sexual imagery that permeates the entire thing. And it's always so desolate and rocky, and my boy Henry doesn't have it easy. And you can always see why it's considered by, even academic institutions as a incredibly fluent and progressive work. That deserves greater analysis and attention.
It's kind of seen as like one of the first major works in American experimental cinema because, yeah, of course you had like experimental cinema before it. Like you had Kubrick doing stuff like 2001 and some of his earlier films, but there was nothing quite like Lynch at the time, especially not in the West. So you had Eastern filmmakers doing stuff like House that was like sort of hyper experimental, sort of strange stuff. But when Lynch comes along in 1977, you're suddenly introduced to this very strange new form of auteur cinema that is designed to make you uncomfortable and question cinematic conventions and question what exactly needs to go into a film to make it a film. Because Eraserhead essentially contains none of the core elements of any traditional type of filmmaking. There isn't a strong narrative. No one really has much of a character or an arc.
Yeah.
You have like body horror kind of coming in, and body horror hadn't really been done to the degree that it's done here before. And like you have a film made in black and white at a time when kind of that was seen, it was like that was a bit old hat. No one really makes black and white films anymore in the 70s. Everything, it feels simultaneously quite antiquated and quite old fashioned, despite being so revolutionary and new.
Yeah. It's always just sort of dismal in its approach. And that's the consistency that you find with Lynch. There's always an uncompromising vision to make you feel disturbed. And whether or not you feel that way at the end of the film, I mean, that's entirely on your part. And I suppose at the time it was refreshing to see a film like this that tackled subjects of reproduction and the enforcement thereof in a society where everyone is practically impotent and the world itself is so cast away from any conventions of society or structure. So it's definitely a film that had a resonance with viewers of the time. Even people who were aspiring auteurs later on, it's had a legacy that is absolutely defined. It's a wonderful film, but it's horrible to watch sometimes.
I mean, I would have loved to have been sort of there for the midnight premiere of this movie, because it was part of a double feature with John Waters' film Pink Flamingos. So I can just imagine kind of what a fucking cultural moment that was. It's like, oh, let's go watch Eraserhead and Pink Flamingos, a film about a baby held together with bandages and a film in which someone eats dog shit live on film.
Yeah. Oh, I can just imagine the audience, like some of them will be like, one of the features finishes and they just go, Jesus Christ, that was unbearable, but don't worry, I'm sure the next film will be better.
No. one of my favorite pieces of like a Eraserhead discourse is Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel sitting on two chairs, and Siskel going on about kind of like how he hates David Lynch's films and how a Eraserhead is like one of the worst films he'd seen of all time, and then Roger Ebert just sits and goes, I think it's very interesting and good. And like, Roger Ebert's a fucking weird one for opinions anyway, because he will love like a lot of genuine classics and stuff that requires love and a lot of really interesting independent movies, and then he will hate like critically acclaimed classics.
Yeah.
And it's fucking baffling.
Critics are always baffling, though.
He got his Eraserhead opinions right, though.
Yeah, he did it.
So, where are we putting Eraserhead on the ladders?
I feel, personally, just as a landmark, just as an element of film history that deserves appreciation, that set off Lynch and his desire to portray his vision in a world that probably needed it. I'm saying this film's going in S, but that's just me.
I would have also put this in S because this was kind of like, I think this was probably like the first David Lynch film that I'd properly sat through when I was trying to get into him.
Mm.
And like sort of just sort of what that sort of made me understand about new forms of filmmaking and introducing me to a completely different style of auteur cinema. Yeah, I kind of agree with S in its, because of its just sheer historical value.
Yeah, I feel we made an agreement. We did it. We solved the problem.
Kind of, then a few years later, in 1980.
Yep.
Here comes the Elephant Man.
Elephant Boy.
As fucking maybe as different to Eraserhead as you can get, because this film almost doesn't contain any of like the typical strange Lynchian alien, like sort of alien qualities, and it's a very well told, very emotional drama film about societal misfits.
Hmm. I think that what's interesting for me, and I'm sure you could probably espouse on that, is why specifically Lynch was drawn to the subject matter, because this is a true story of a man who was deformed to this extent, who faced repulsion on a daily basis.
Hmm.
Perhaps in a similar way that, you know, Lynch's first film was at the time. You know, why do you think he was drawn to the tale of John Merrick?
I feel sort of with John Merrick, it was a person who, it sort of, if you go on the film's narrative, it's a man who learned to be respected and elevated himself and pushed past society's sort of barriers of what he was, and he sort of learned to understand that he wasn't monstrous, and he taught other people that he wasn't this sort of monstrous figure. And there's that brilliant scene in The Elephant Man where he's in the theater and he gets this standing ovation from the entire crowd. And like, if you look into The Elephant Man's production history, it kind of all comes from Mel Brooks, the guy who did like Blazing Saddles and Spaceballs, being absolutely in love with Eraserhead and saying, if you want to make another film, I'll fund it. You could make whatever the fuck you want. I'll just give you money to make another movie.
Mm.
And it is sort of mirroring this Elephant Man narrative of Lynch is given a chance to make more of a name for himself, to make his art much more sort of widely appreciated in the same way that John Merrick breaks through those societal barriers. And so there's that really great mirroring between the two artistically that I find is very endearing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I feel like there's always a resonance with what Lynch... I mean, this was one of the two adaptations. Is it two? Is The Straight Story an adaptation as well?
Yeah, The Straight Story is like another true story adaptation that's like quite somewhat similar in tone, I think.
Hmm. Because obviously, Lynch makes a name for himself with the disturbing parallels he draws to aspects of modern day society or contemporary society, and how those implicate on his filmmaking. So to see a film that's sort of unfleeting in its compassion for the subject matter, and how powerful it is in its portrayal of real struggle, of a much more human struggle than was conveyed in Eraserhead, that was more relatable and direct with an audience. It can always be seen as a very sort of bizarre anomaly in his filmography, but when you look deeper, just beyond the surface of, I don't know, Mulholland Drive or Lost Highway, you see a filmmaker who has a range. He has a capability to produce films that target someone's emotions in ways that one wouldn't expect. And The Elephant Man for me is always like kind of that unexpected, haha, no, now I'm making an important movie.
Mm. It's the first sign that Lynch has like a huge dynamic range in what he can present on screen, and kind of like, even though it is a completely different style of film to Eraserhead, it's still one that I rank quite highly in sort of my general David Lynch ranking.
It employed less of the techniques he would be known for, but it was still a work that aims to sort of convey or challenge our sensibilities of the repulsive and transform that into an object of unabashed empathy. A core as of John Merrick of transforming that which may be seen as abhorrent into something that is ultimately beautiful and human, which is what the film's about. It's why the quote, I'm not an animal, I'm a human being, resonates so much for our culture.
So like, the reason why it's kind of so special and timeless.
Yeah,
it's because of that sort of great message of acceptance and empathy towards others, and it's a film that's like, of his films, I think it's the most relevant.
And it's, I suppose it's sort of like a light at the end of the tunnel after how desolate and how devoid of hope or salvation Eraserhead was. As to whether or not it's on the same level as Eraserhead, I'm personally, I'm feeling I'm gonna put The Elephant Man on an A.
I can see A, because I do have some, I do have like the odd issue with it. Like, I think some of the pacing on it isn't particularly well handled, and there are moments where, like some of the other characters don't ever move out of being black or white, evil or good.
Yeah.
Which I think having that kind of moral, there isn't much of like a sort of moralistic argument with some of the characters, which I feel like would have added more to it. Like if you explored more about his like Merrick's exploitation, or raised more questions about Merrick's free will in like a lot of these situations, I think that would have been, that would have just been the sort of cherry on the hypothetical top.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think this is like a firm A tier.
Yeah. Still a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it's still absolutely phenomenal and well, it's the David Lynch film I think most people know, or they know the film The Elephant Man, where they don't know it's by David Lynch, but it's the one that most people know.
Yeah.
So next we have David Lynch's first foray into coloured filmmaking, feature filmmaking, with Blue Velvet. Also his first collaboration with Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan.
Yeah, who are, you know, long-standing collaborators with Lynch.
They will pop up from time to time a lot throughout this list. So where do you stand on Blue Velvet? Because I rewatched it recently, and I didn't like it as much as I originally did, but I still love it.
I still
find it like very. I think it's almost I think this is the first film of his that tries to be quite grim and dark, and doesn't quite. It kind of does it in an almost caricature level for me.
I feel like it's still a return to form in how Lynch presents his vision as almost like a dictator over the work of the film, because it's uncompromising and it's present constantly. And the idea of Blue Velvet always felt to me like an exploration of suburban America, and sort of deconstructing and tearing apart the mask of civility that's held up by that society and that sort of echelon. And it also explored much more grounded roots of dark subject matter, such as like drug abuse, and there's also definitely perversion. Perversion is a big one. And it deconstructed those aspects in less like a razor head, in a sense where the idea of parentage is the core of that film, which is challenged, but it's never quite sort of explored and portrayed with a sort of realism. It's usually a backdrop, and Blue Velvet felt like quite a very sort of aggressive approach, where it sort of deconstructed and analysed all of these aspects of America and the cores of these values, with quite a much more bizarre agenda. A lot of the aspects of Lynch's sort of narrative works are still there. There's a much more of a base for narrative beats throughout this entire film, more so than a razor head. But it's, I don't know.
I kind of like the way I do like the presentation of suburban America as this sort of superficial sense of security, because you have that brilliant opening sequence where you have all the traditional suburban imagery, and then it cuts to the shot of like all the bugs under the ground, and just it's this quite sort of disgusting image, and the way that there are just characters killed in their garden, like there's the guy who's choked right at the beginning of the movie on like a hose pipe, and Kyle MacLachlan's character gets abducted from his own sort of suburban garden at one point, and of course you then have one of the climactic moments of Isabella Rossellini's character making her way to the home of Laura Dern. And just that kind of horrifying sequence of her in this trance there. There is a sense of, but there's a kind of sense that being in a community is almost this sort of perceived sense of security, and that you still have to have almost like a selfish aspect of yourself in order to protect yourself, which I suppose is where the perversion aspect comes in, since that is mostly an entirely selfish act or way of thinking. And I like those aspects. The issue is for me with the movie is that it feels like it's presented seriously, but it never feels serious.
Yeah. I suppose in a way, all the aspects of like disgust and horror that come about from unearthing everything I mean, like the image of the bugs in particular, that always felt that crucial to me into understanding the film, because essentially you find that the most Lynchian trademark in the film is the depiction of unearthing this dark underbelly in a seemingly idealized town. Mm. But yeah, it almost felt as if the stakes were just not quite there. In a sense, it's a mystery film, and it owes quite a lot to 1950s noir, and there are conventions such as like the femme fatale and absolute, like this moral hard lines of like good and evil, and the villain, the antagonist in particular, is all there, but it's almost kind of quite rocky, I'd say, and in the same way that you said it doesn't feel as if it's taking its subject matter seriously enough.
Mm. I mean this movie has Dennis Hopper's best performance, but he's almost like one of the elements that draws me out of this movie, because he's so like comically evil, he's so cartoonishly the villain. That, yeah, it's amazing to watch and it's amazingly entertaining as a performance, but when everything else surrounding him is so, like, there is such like a realistic portrayal of sexual abuse throughout the film, that as soon as Dennis Hopper's character comes in and he's huffing on his oxygen mash and he's forcing a guy to sing Roy Orbison songs, it's like, yeah. Suddenly it's okay, this is like kind of almost an overindulgence of Lynch's elements.
Hmm. There was always something quite comical about Frank Booth as a character.
Hmm.
I mean, his split personalities was always... I mean, the thing with Lynch is you can always go quite far and sort of approach his ideas for characterization with a sort of humorous undertone.
Hmm.
But I don't feel like that was the right move with Booth's character. And the whole, like, baby and daddy thing, it's just a bit bizarre. And not necessarily in the right way when this film is attempting to portray some very dark subject matter. Mm. But yeah, still one of his best performances in Hopper's case. I mean, better than fucking Tim Cooper from Super Mario.
Would you be comfortable putting this film in the B tier? Or do you think it deserves higher?
I'm feeling B tier. I still think it's worth a watch as, I mean, B for Blue Velvet. But
the Blue Velvet tier.
Yeah, this is the Blue Velvet tier, which nothing else can penetrate. There's nothing coming in that tier except from Blue Velvet. But yeah, I definitely worth a watch. I still think it's a good film. But When you bring into understanding how Lynch is trying to sort of convey conventions of genre and thematic study that weren't really there with Eraserhead, because that was almost devoid of any real narrative, his trappings begin to sort of appear, and I feel like a more of a serious approach of the source matter, that not the source matter, the writing would have been a better approach, because everything in Frank Booth's portrayal feels kind of just all wacky crazy. He sniffed the gas.
He huff. Speaking of stuff that only belongs in the tier that it's going to be in, the next film is Dune. David Lynch famously hates science fiction and doesn't like making science fiction things.
Yeah.
I have a book that's about like famous famous science fiction movies that were never made, and there is a chapter on the two science fiction movies that Lynch wanted to make, Ronnie Rocket and One Saliva Bubble, but neither of them are really science fiction movies.
Mm.
So, getting Dune is like such a strange choice for him, because this is another thing that I got from Lynch on Lynch. Like, he reads the book and he says the book's very interesting, but there's a lot to go at.
Yeah.
So he makes a 2-hour movie that tries to adapt a dense 600-page book, and there is a lot missing. Like, a lot that should be there but isn't. Some characters are just almost completely different to what they are in the book compared to the film. You think Dune's weird, because the subject of Dune, which a lot of people interpret as being about, like, Zen philosophy and almost like a pseudo-Buddhist style of philosophy, you'd think that fits Lynch quite well with his belief in transcendental meditation stuff. But he somehow gets almost every aspect of this movie wrong. He gets the scope and the visual aspect right. This movie looks, for like a 1984 movie, this film looks incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
But everything else just completely drops the ball. I mean, even Toto's soundtrack doesn't even save the movie.
Yeah. That's the worst crime of all.
Toto, the people behind Africa, fucking Pamela and Roseanne and Hold the Line, could not do a good science fiction movie soundtrack. None of the cast are particularly good. They look like they don't know what the fuck is happening with any of the subject matter of the film. Should have never been made. I'm putting it in the lowest possible tier.
I'll put it there. For me, I don't know, comparatively with his other works, it's one of the, in many cases, you can see it as the least strange film he's ever made, but it's also the most strange, because you think, why did he make this? Why is he even there? You see his name tied to it, and you just think, what? Because instinctively you know that Lynch probably didn't have a symbiotic relationship with this, the film itself. He didn't have a connection to it, or a real connection to the work. He just kind of read the book and was like, here's a lot here, I don't know what I'm going to do. And ultimately the film's plot is just muddled. Shit just happens, and you're just like, what the fuck is... What?
It's a lot of, like, waiting around for, oh, there's the sandworm, oh, there's the... there's Stilgar, oh, there's these characters, there's the Freeman, okay, there's the... put your hand in the magic box test.
The magic.
It's waiting for the scenes that you recognise to happen, and then when they do happen, you go, "Oh, that wasn't very interesting."
Yeah, it's a shame, but it's what I expected when I saw Dune. That I was just like, "Yeah, this ain't gonna go well."
Another film I don't have much to say on is Wild at Heart, his next film. I don't think too much. I think it's very fun. I think it's the funnest of the David Lynch movies, but I don't think it's anything spectacular.
Yeah. It's a wild ride, is it? I fell into a trap. I said a pun.
You did it. You did the old classic. Wild at Heart is a wild ride from wild director David Lynch.
Wild director David Lynch.
A real journalist moment.
Yeah, it's an okay exploration of eroticism, and there's more of the noir shit now. Don't worry,
there's lots of film noir characterization here with Sailor and, is it Lulu or Luna or something? I can't remember her name.
Yeah, Sailor in particular, because there was a quote of him going on about his snake skin.
Oh yeah, is this the one near the end of the film, or the one?
Yeah,
where he gets harassed by, like, the street gang, who call him a gay slur for having a snake skin coat.
Yeah, and he's just like, this is my snake skin.
This is my snake skin coat. Nicolas Cage. Also, Nicolas Cage sings in this movie. I don't think he's ever sung in another movie that I've ever seen him in.
He's got to have sung some point.
Have been in something where he sings, but this is the first and only time I've seen him do it. He's quite good at singing. He's got a decent voice on him.
Yeah. I mean, there's still room to have a lot of a critical appreciation of this film. For one, Lynch believes in his... this is a situation where Lynch does kind of explain his view. He kind of goes, for me, the film is the idea of finding love in hell. And it's just, it's a compilation of ideas that come along of, you know, all the dark stuff and the light stuff. And that I think for me as well, the ending being quite, quite happy.
It's quite triumphant, actually. Yeah. Like, Sailor gets out of prison, he's reunited with his wife and kid, and they drive off into the sunset.
Yeah. Let me tell you now, that ain't characteristic. That's not a characteristic of my boy.
That is the, aside from, like, the straight story, that is the happiest ending a David Lynch film has.
Yeah. Well, you did it. Well done.
I like Willem Dafoe a lot in this film, actually. I forgot Willem Dafoe was in it, and I was like, oh no, Willem Dafoe has a weird mustache and some false teeth.
Yeah.
He's really good in this movie. I think it's like quite sort of creepy, quite manipulative criminal good character.
Good old Bobby.
His head gets exploded at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
It's a nice head explosion, and he does a weird voice, and he is quite sort of, ugh.
Yeah.
It's like, he's ugh personified in that movie.
Mm.
What do you think Wild at Heart belongs? Because I'm bouncing between C and B, but I think it's like a high C, low B for me.
Yeah. Here's another thing, kids. So the other thing that people like to do on tier lists is, if you feel that a particular thing deserves the same rank as another thing, you can rank one above the other in terms of which you like more, of like a high C or a low C. So for the time being, because we can make amendments if we decide that towards the end, I'm putting Wild at Heart in a C.
You know what? I agree with you. I think it's a good like 6 out of 10 experience. It's It's not boring.
It's not Dune.
It's not Dune, but it isn't. It doesn't quite reach the heights of his other movies. Like, visually, it's very interesting, but and Sailor and Laura Dern's character have a really great chemistry. Their relation kind of pulls me in, and Willem Dafoe's great, but it's just sort of the general plot of it feels like he's gone, oh, this is a very interesting film noir plot from, like, the 50s. What if I did that, but with my visual style?
Yeah.
It's like yeah, there's the elements of, like, revenge. Like, there's the revenge filler element of, you know, he's constantly being hunted down by different quirky bounty killers and, like, Harvey Dean Stanton and, I think it's Grace Zabinski plays, Lulu or whatever her name is, mother, and that kind of relationship, how she's almost presented in this, like, initially quite mob boss style characterization of she's the one who instigates all the bounty hunters to go after Sailor. I think that's like, it's cool that it draws on those influences, but it never really does enough with them for me.
Still, as one of Lynch's sort of mystery films, oh, not really mystery, it's more like a crime film. Covering the same sort of ground that Blue Velvet did. It could be Dune. Instead of saying it could be worse, it could be Dune.
Could be Dune.
Yeah, and here we are, at a C for the time being.
So next we have Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. Potentially, like, this is, I think, the weirdest addition to his catalogue, because it's a prequel to a TV series which after the second season he kind of hated making.
Yeah. I have a confession.
Yeah.
I've not seen Fire Walk With Me yet.
So this one's all on me then, is it?
I'm putting it on you, and I'm going to assume I'm going to leave it off my tier list. If there was a never seen before list, I'd put it there.
But in that section.
So I'm leaving this on you. I love Twin Peaks, but I'm yet to see Fire Walk With Me, and I'm going to get on that as soon as the pub job lets me.
So Fire Walk With Me is my second favourite David Lynch movie, but it's a difficult one to talk about in that it's a film that is but kind of almost butchered by the studio, in that a lot of the scenes that were supposed to be elongated and explain stuff were cut and reduced. So what you see isn't truly Lynch's Lynch's vision. But what is presented is still this, I think, much better than Blue Velvet. This tells a story of sexual abuse much clearer, and it's a lot more interesting. And I don't know whether that's because we have two seasons of Twin Peaks before this, which built on Laura Palmer's character and the universe, so that you feel more adjusted to it. But everything that Blue Velvet failed for me works in Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me. And I think it's the best sounding David Lynch film in terms of the Bad Lamenti score. I think Cheryl Lee gives maybe the best performance in Lynch's earlier films. And just the way that it handles and sort of takes the Twin Peaks universe into the darker tone that will follow into the third season of the show is phenomenal, because it's great seeing David Lynch have such creative control over this universe for the first time. And for me, Fire Walk With Me is like an easy S for me. I adore this film a lot. It's got a great cast as well. David Bowie's great in his one scene. Cheryl Lee's amazing. Ray Wise does an outstanding job as Leland. And just everything about it feels so perfect for the universe, despite the fact that it was butchered by the studio.
Mm.
So I'm slapping it up in S.
Bro, that's moment. A bro moment. I can't confirm. I ain't seen it.
But you have seen the next film, which is Lost Highway.
Yeah.
I think this one might be possibly the most polarizing between us, because I don't like Lost Highway and you are a big fan of it.
I dig Lost Highway. I love them roads. Lost Highway is a bit fucking. It's very neo-noir again. Nothing wrong with that. And it follows Big Lad, Bill Pullman, who's a musician, and he begins getting these weird VHS tapes of him and his wife in their home, and he's suddenly convicted of murder. And then in typical Lynchian fashion, everything goes off the deep end, and he just disappears and gets replaced by a younger guy, a mechanic, who leads a different life. It's bizarre. It's a wacky exploration of all sorts of shit. I'm talking just a lot of French New Wave stuff. I'm talking German Expressionism. It's also been described as a psychological thriller and a horror film. I think immediately when I... the other week I watched Perfect Blue with Kevin.
Yeah.
And I kind of got a similar feel to that as I did with Lost Highway. Just the idea of, just identity.
It's that kind of dual identity thing, which I think is probably the strongest element of Lost Highway with, I think it's Balthazar Getty and Bill Pullman's sort of constantly shifting performances. I think that is probably the most interesting aspect of the movie for me. Like, seeing those two sides of the character being portrayed in such unique ways by either actor.
Yeah. And as we said, it's kind of in a trilogy with Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire, which are, you know, three of which I'd say they're some of the darkest films in its filmography, which is weird because it's set in Los Angeles. Then again, Falling Down was made and set in Los Angeles, so yeah, I know. But yeah, it's subversive, and it's just demented. There's the ideas of the parallel stories and multiple narratives is a convention of Lynch. especially in the other films in that specific trilogy. But I don't know, every aspect about it, the cinematography, the framing of each scene, it felt much more meticulous and aggressive than any other Lynch film I'd found. Although I'd probably put it in second place in terms of cinematography to a film we'll discuss later. But it was an experience. It's kind of hard to describe because, as in a similar way to the other films in that trilogy, you kind of have to see them for yourself and just go, ooh.
This one is probably due a rewatch from me because I wasn't as drawn into the universe, and it's like one of the David Lynch films where instead of being good confused, I was bad confused, and that I couldn't particularly follow it very well. And I ought to give it. I probably will at some point give it a second chance and give it a rewatch because there are definitely elements I enjoy. I like all the visual stuff of just driving at night and kind of what that means and the elements of the fear of the unknown that incorporates. And I like some of the weirder, all the VHS elements and the shifting protagonist stuff I enjoy. But other than that, I struggle to really enjoy it. So for me, I'd put it in C for me with Wild at Heart. But where would you put it on yours?
I'm putting Lost Highway in S. And that's probably a bit fucked considering we don't agree here. But look at that wah-wah-wee-wah moment right there.
Real polarizing moment there.
Yeah. But that's the thing. That's what we were saying at the beginning. Because everyone can respond to Lynch in a different way. I really like Lost Highway. Kevin thinks it's just above Dune.
I think it's fine. I've only ever seen it once. I will watch it again at some point.
I'm going to watch it for the third time at some point.
You bitch. Okay, so the next one is as different from Lost Highway as you can get because it's time for the straight story.
Now, I think that all I have to really sum up to explain how confusing this film is, not as a film itself, because it's actually quite, you know, straight ways, but for Lynch that is confusing.
It's blatant. It's kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if we can see it on the tier list, but there's a poster of the same film, and if you look towards the top, you can see it's actually distributed by Walt Disney.
Yeah, my DVD of it is it's like a film 4 DVD.
Yeah,
it's got a weird amount of like backing, and I think it was a lot of critics at the time said, oh, this is David Lynch's first real film. This is his first proper, regarded piece of cinema.
Mm.
It's like, okay, have you sort of dismissed all the other, like, seven or eight movies that he's made prior as, like, not being real cinema? Yes, we have. Why? Because it's too weird for general audiences. But this is David Lynch's first proper film.
Yeah. And it's a heartwarming story. It's a story of a bloke named Alvin, who is he's getting on a bit. He's a World War II veteran, and his estranged brother has just had a stroke, dealing with health problems, and the there's always a sort of loose approach to impending mortality in the film, but Alvin can't drive the over 200-mile journey to reach his brother, so he decides to, hey, you know what, I got this lawnmower, let's go
boys.
In the same way as the Elephant Man, this is a true story, and always, as is always common with these sort of like these dramas that Lynch makes, which just come out of the blue. There's a real attention to humanity, which you really don't expect. And with critics at the time, everyone was just like, what? You can't make a film that has human characters in it. You can't make a film What? That's weird.
You can't make a normal drama film, David.
David? Come on.
You fucking weirdo. What are you doing, David?
David. But yeah, I personally really like this film. I wouldn't put it in S, but it's just a heartwarming experience of a man who's, you know, after years of sort of estrangement from this one relative who he knows is on the brink of death, he's trying to make amends, and it's so passionate and brisk in its attempt to portray these characteristics that are just have never really been seen before in Lynch's work, aside from like that, you know, that one time where he was like, hey, John Merrick. Now, personally, I'm going to put it in A. Because I love this film. It's not S, but...
I like it, but I don't think to the same extent, because with The Elephant Man, I think the emotional story isn't as resonant for me when compared to The Elephant Man, which is the kind of closest approximation that you can have. I think that it's the way that it's presented is, for Alvin, you don't get as invested in his character because his sort of journey doesn't feel as transformative as John Merrick for me. It's a much more deeper personal film, and it's more understated and more quietly emotional. And while I do think that Lynch presents kind of Alvin's his sort of understanding of mortality and his sort of growing understanding throughout the film that, you know, age changes your perspective of the world, and you have to kind of adapt with the age that you're growing into. And I find those elements really interesting and very well presented, but the emotional payoff just isn't as potent as The Elephant Man for me.
Yeah.
But I like it more than Blue Velvet, so I'm going to put it at like a high B for me.
See? Even when we disagree, that's still pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like there's going to be more disagreement with this next one as well, because the next one is Mulholland Drive.
Oh.
This is the one I have most recently rewatched, actually. And I do enjoy it, but I don't think I enjoy it quite to the degree that I used to.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because we had a film thing. We used to watch films at like this extracurricular thing.
Yeah.
Our teacher was like, "Hey, boys, we're going to introduce you to the good shit. Here's Mulholland Drive. Sleep well tonight." And we watched it. I remember we had a conversation about it for afterwards that was just like, "What the fuck? What? This is some deep shit. This is the English literature stuff we were looking for.
This is the type of stuff that we like."
Yeah. Now, personally, I still love this film. It's the kind of film that my dad hates, so I love it. And it's the same, again, a very similar premise in sort of the sort of beats, I guess, to Lost Highway. There's aspects of doubling, of split personality, of a woman who she's crashed a car, shit car accident. Oh, now she's in Los Angeles and this other woman's here and she's blonde, but she bears the same sort of similarities. And oh, shit, now we're different women. Oh, also there's this cowboy at night at a weird ranch. Oh, my God. Now we're at a bar and we're singing stuff and it's like singing a weird Spanish version of an American song, and now everything's ended and now there's a weird box. Oh, no. But,
It's the one that I think most accurately portrays dream logic, and it's his strongest dissection of dreams in general, I think. Because, and when I say that I like it less, I mean it's gone from an S to an A tier. I still think it's like exceptional. It's an exceptional film. I especially love it's the almost disconnected nature of every scene in it. Especially like you know the diner scene quite early on in the film.
Yeah,
that I think is this film surmised perfectly. It sets up the logic of the movie so well with the conversation of the guy explaining his dream, and then it's slowly the elements of it slowly seeping into reality.
Yeah,
and then kind of that harsh, nightmarish figure emerging, sort of drawing you into this idea of, like, the city of dreams isn't as idyllic as the perception that it has.
Yeah.
So here is how horrible it is.
And I mean, all of that segment, that those scenes, they have absolutely no impact on the overarching plot. Aside from when our protagonists return, and they don't return, they go to this diner, the same diner that this scene is set in, and aspects of that nightmarish encounter return, because what this really does is it intrudes on what the audience expects from a narrative and deconstructs it completely. Like, not even with conventions, not even with sort of themes of neo-noir stuff or anything like that. It's just a complete dissolution and a focus on dream logic that is harsh, to say the least. And it'll be the longest 2 hours or so that you endure in your entire life, because when that film starts, you can't stop.
And it is fantastic. Like, the sequences where they go to visit the apartment that this woman is allegedly from, and the stuff that they find in it is horrifying and awful, and I hate it.
Yeah.
But also, yum. This is the shit that I like.
That's the good shit. But yeah, I've still maintained my thoughts pretty closely on Mulholland. For me, at the minute, I'm going to rank that as a high A. I'm going to rank it above The Elephant Man. I'm going to slap that right there.
I agree with you. I think that is exactly where it deserves to be. Perfect agree with you there in the placement. Now for his final film. 2006's Inland Empire.
S. Slap it in S.
Slap it fucking right there. It's my favourite David Lynch film.
Slap it in. Right.
Anything else. It's amazing.
Slap it in S. That, this film. Fucking hell. In many ways, Inland Empire is one of the hardest films I've ever had to watch. Because of just... It's hard to describe how uncompromising it is. And not uncompromising on how unfleeting it is. It's hard to stomach at times because of just how it's dizzying in a way. Not only just because of how chaotic the narrative is, but the cinematography filmed on a camcorder. David Lynch was like, yeah, this is what we're doing now. It's experimental with a capital E.
It is sort of legitimately terrifying, and it's the fact that all the camera angles are so close and pulled in to, so there is never a moment where there is like the safety of a wide shot in this movie, because everything is so tight and horrible.
It's a bizarre watch in so many ways, and It's almost like a carnivalesque sort of celebration of the absurd in a way. There's a humor to it even when it's just horrible. There's so much stuff. Sometimes it's a sitcom, Sometimes it's a parallel story that's going on in Poland, and there's dancing people, and there's screwdrivers going into people where you shouldn't put screwdrivers.
It is disturbing on a very fundamental level, and it bounces between being like, you know, typically disturbing in all the violence and stuff like that, but then there's a quiet disturbing element to it, like the very early scene where Laura Dern is visited by Grace Zabinski, and she's taught, and they're having the conversation about her future career, and it's like, oh, and there's like a sort of strange, almost Mulholland Drive-esque feel to it, where there's a dreaminess, and there's sort of almost an element of dramatic irony being set up. Or there's the scene where Laura Dern sees herself in the warehouse, just like from the middle distance.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, don't like that.
I mean, what's worse is that even this like messes with reality on a greater level than Mulholland Drive did, specifically because it included aspects of his previous works, like straight up, like Rabbits is there.
Oh yeah, which is just like a different short film that he was doing at the time.
Yeah, and it's just there, and almost like on an interconnected level, it all joins together and just messes with you. And there's an antagonistic force, but it's like a mix of the of Death from Final Destination and just like a beast from Cruelty Squad, like a man from Cruelty Squad, a narcotics guy from Cruelty Squad, is a horrible, horrible thing, and he's the worst thing. Forget Killer Bob, this guy is the worst.
This thing is, no, he is the most terrifying element of this entire film.
Yeah. Like a tormented, like a phantom. That's what he is. He's the phantom. He's a phantom. Mm. He's a spooky guy.
He has that weird deformed Laura Dern face that I just, no, don't like that one. Not a fan of that at all.
Yep.
Get it out of here. Get it gone. Take it away. I don't want it in my film anymore.
Man just has a light bulb in his mouth for some reason at one point.
It is legitimately awful, and I hate it. And it's it upsets me on like and disturbs me on such like this core level that it's you just want to go back for more of that film, and you want to keep watching more of it for more of these moments. And I'm just upset that this was his last movie, that we're never gonna get anything like this again.
Well, has he stated that he's stopped now?
Yeah, he's not gonna make any other feature films, I don't think.
What?
Like, and he the way that he kind of phrases stuff is, I'm only gonna make stuff if I have the idea to make stuff, and he hasn't had an idea to make a movie since 2006, and with Twin Peaks, the third season of Twin Peaks was kind of like the last thing he'd filmed anyway, but that was like the last film thing he did.
Yeah.
So it's doubtful that he'll even do anything.
Well, that's a way to end it, I guess.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So
we've done it. We did all of his movies.
If there's a film I'm going to show to my girlfriend, it will definitely be Inland Empire.
There you go. 3 hours of just, I don't like any of this. What's happening? Why is this happening? Oh, what's this? Oh, why is that looking like that? Oh, why is she now in a completely different thing, going by a completely different name, being a completely different person for, like, no reason?
Hmm.
It's just going to be horrifying and fun for all.
Fun for the whole family.
Fun for the whole family. I would show my... This is the type of film that my mother would call weirdo shit. Because every time she sees me watching a movie, she's like, "Are you watching more weirdo shit?" And I'm like, yes, I am watching more weirdo shit.
Stop watching weirdo shit, Cameron.
Occasionally she'll like the weirdo shit that I watch, but sometimes it'll confuse her, like The Lighthouse.
Yeah.
She didn't understand the bits of The Lighthouse that she saw. She didn't understand why Willem Dafoe was being leaded around like a dog. It's just, why is he like a dog? Is he going to kill him? I was like, yeah, he's going to bury him alive. And she's like, oh, fun. Great. Why are you like this?
God damn it. But anyway, there we have it. Inland Empire peak. Dune is Dune. Dune is Dune, dude. And I guess we've done it. We did what we set out to do.
We have.
And I'm proud of both of us.
We have made great progress.
Yeah. You're doing a great job with your therapy, boys. We're really proud of
you. You've done God's work here, people.
God's work, like Kanye would say.
Mr. West.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
How am I doing, Ye? You tell me. So yeah, this has been another episode of a good bit of the cinematography. Thanks for joining us. It's been great.
It has been an experience.
Yeah, like all the other experiences. This like time,
all the other different ones that have happened, this was indeed one of them.
Yeah. I've been James.
And I've been Kevin.
And I guess this is goodbye. The theme is probably playing at this point.
Yeah, probably. Just don't forget to check out the old social medias, the Twitters and the Instagrams.
Yeah, we use those.
Use them to get updates on the program.
Yeah. And we got some good news, because we've been doing these episodes over the internet at the minute, because it's not easy. But I'm telling you now, we're doing this shit in person.
In the words of Bill O'Reilly, fuck it, we'll do it live.
Yeah, we're doing it live. So get ready for that. It's going to be a lot better, because the internet isn't always perfect, I'll be honest.
So, sometimes it isn't. I think the audio quality will increase when we do it in person.
Yeah.
Possibly, we don't have to do. We won't have to use fucking Zencaster.
Yeah.
We can record straight onto Audacity.
Hell yeah.
And it'll be fine.
It'll be straight funky.
Just fucking. Ooh! Very nice.
Very nice. And yeah, it'll be a lot better than me trying to edit the whistle
to match.
Yeah. Because there was so much I had to take out of that episode for you people at home, and I'm sure it sounded all right, but my God.
it was, let's be honest, for you, a bit of a slog.
Bit of a slog. But that's no matter, because we enjoy doing this, and we enjoy bringing it to whoever enjoys listening to it.
We sort of enjoy, we do enjoy doing these, which is, I think probably the best thing to do when you're when you've got to do this kind of thing.
Yeah. But anyway, that's all from us. Au revoir.
Goodbye. Remember to follow the Twitters and the Instagrams.
Yeah, don't forget that.
We'll be back next time, I guess.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.